So I'm going to talk about VAIU, which is a work we're doing at HP Software. So I was asked by Arif here, why VAIU? And VAIU is the Lord of the Winds, the Hindu Lord of the Winds, and this work is about controlling the cloud. So it's a very fitting name, because we're trying to actually develop technology that helps control the cloud, and the wind moves the cloud. So VAIU is a nice name to it. So let me start with a short video which explains the problems that we're trying to solve.
Hello, boss. You called me.
Oh, management decided that we need to move to the cloud.
Cloud?
I hired a cloud consultant. She will help you.
Hello. Are you the cloud expert?
I am a cloud consultant. I love the cloud. The cloud will save you money. The cloud is wonderful.
Oh, management called to complain that our website is so slow. How did it get so bad? Fix this or there will be hell to pay.
I need help fixing our website performance in the cloud. Help me. Cloud expert, help me please.
Just add more machines. It is easy. It is the cloud. The cloud is endless. The cloud is beautiful.
Oh, management just called about our cloud monthly bill. Our cloud cost went through the roof. You better fix this, or there will be hell to pay.
Our cloud cost went through the roof. Tell me what to do. Cloud expert, please.
Just shut down machines. It is easy. It is the cloud. The cloud is great.
But then our performance would be bad again. You are not helpful. You are fired. I need help. Someone. Please.
Hi, Joe. Perhaps you should use VAIU.
VAIU. What is VAIU?
VAIU helps you understand how to manage your cloud applications. VAIU is very smart. It learns by itself. It will save you money. You will not have to worry about your performance. So, it will save your job. It is a Hewlett-Packard innovation. Get it now.
All right. So now we can get serious. So I hope this kind of explains what the problem that people in large companies are facing when they're actually starting to move their applications to cloud. So basically, we see a very large shift in the application management, the way people do application management. And the shift is actually not in the process itself, but mostly in how long it takes to do it. So the normal application management lifecycle is you observe and estimate your performance and demand, you decide on capacity, and then you deploy. Now, in traditional IT environments, this takes months, it's manual, it's a very slow process, so everything is fine. Now, in cloud environments, this is supposed to take minutes, and it's supposed to be automatic, or at least this is the vision of the cloud. This is what we're sold. The cloud promises to optimize availability and performance, to optimize the cost and the resources all at the same time. Whereas in traditional IT, this optimizing all three was very hard. You'd usually just buy for the maximum usage. Here, because of the way you can scale up and down, you can optimize all three. But as companies that actually move into public clouds have already seen, like Netflix, if you don't really understand, if you don't have a good understanding how your application performs and under different loads and demands, you can actually get very destructive results by doing this simple auto-scaling policies in cloud environments. So it's either ineffective, so you don't get any optimization, or it could be very destructive. So you could actually get the opposite effect of what you wanted. Either you will pay too much, or you lose on performance and availability. So now we can go to VAIU. So what is VAIU? VAIU is a technology, and hopefully will be a product in the next year or so, which automatically learns and learns the behavior of different cloud applications and analyzes the trade-offs between the demand, the performance, and the cost in the cloud environment. So this is a very high level of statement of what value is. What I'd like to show first, before I go into the technology and behind value, what are the kind of use cases, how do we see value being used by actual customers that use value as a service. So I'll go through an example, and this is a made-up example. These are not the real screenshots of the product, but it will illustrate how somebody might use a system like value. So I'm a retailer of a flower shop. I'm deployed in the cloud, in some public cloud environment. And basically, what I want to do is understand how much budget I need to ask for my infrastructure in the cloud. So I go into Vayu, into the screen. I need to do a budget analysis of my cloud infrastructure. And I see the month of February. So the month of February has 20 regular days, 8 weekend days. But actually, it has another special day, which is Valentine's Day. So these are scenarios. Each one of these days represents a different type of usage demand on my system. So it could be that on Valentine's Day, there's a lot more purchases, so a lot more people coming in, just browsing quickly, buying flowers, sending it, as opposed to a regular day where the mix is very different. So I need to understand how much infrastructure, what's the effect on my systems, on my applications, on a scenario of Valentine's Day compared to a regular day or weekend day. And of course, for every application, this would be different. It is these scenarios, the analysis of what is the demand for different scenarios is something that the owner of the application is aware of. Now I want to compare different cloud providers, assuming I can be deployed on Amazon, on the HP cloud, on a private cloud, or any other cloud, and I check which ones I want to compare against. Then I say to Vayu, okay, run the analysis, I name it, and Vayu runs in the background, and I'll explain what it does in the background later on. But basically what it does, it runs a sandbox environment on each one of these cloud provider with these different usage scenarios and learns the behavior of the site with different volumes of user for each demand scenario. So I have a Valentine's Day, I will test for what's the scale with 100 users, 200 users, 1,000 users, or whatever limit the user puts on the test. So it's basically a test. After it's done, it may take several hours to do it, I can now, as the owner, as the business owner of the application, I can go and see a summary and, of course, drill down into the overall cost and performance of my application. So I can compare different providers and see how much they would cost me for this month, what's the cost per user, what's the performance per transactions, what's the maximum number of VMs, and of course there could be other parameters that might interest me. I could look at it for a particular day, not just for the whole month, because Valentine's Day may be a special day. I can see whether the cost per user increases or not. And because we do all these tests on the behavior of the application, we can actually do what-if analysis. So Joe may want to see, he sees that the average response time is 1.2 seconds, but he wants to understand what would be the cost saving for him if he lets the response time go up to 2.5 seconds. So he knows he will take a performance hit, but maybe it will save him enough money per user that will make it worth it. Of course, that all relates to how much he's expecting to get a return from every user. What's the average return for every user? He might specify that the maximum number of VMs he wants is 60, because that's all he can manage, and then he would get what will be the cost, the performance hit based on that specification. Now, once he's done, he basically understands, he has visibility to how much it's going to cost him next month, and he could do the what-if analysis for the next month or next quarter or next year. He transfers it, the results, to John. John doesn't really care about the cost as much. He cares about deployment and keeping keeping the operations running smoothly. So he can look at the analysis from a different standpoint of what are the actual rules, sizing rules that are required to maintain the performance that that Joe specified for me. And of course, for different volumes of users, you might get a different type of deployment scenario. So for 5,000 users, you may need more of your application servers compared to your IIS servers, if that's the deployment architecture. And for 100 users, it may be much smaller, and there would be a different mix of servers required. So he can look at it and understand what would be required to keep up the performance, and then, of course, apply it to production, so Vayu can actually go into production and implement these rules automatically as the demand pattern changes. So this is basically, through this usage scenario, you can see the type of use cases that we're targeting with a technology like Vayu. But what's the technology behind the scene? So the idea is the following. You have your demand on your application is deployed in the cloud, and it's being monitored. It's being monitored both at the user level, at the business level, whatever, the performance, the usage volume, the type of users, but also at the system level, CPU utilization, memory utilization, middleware metrics, any type of metrics that you can provide for your application will help Vayu learn better the how to scale and how to size your application. So your application is running. The demand is either real by real users or simulated by simulation by tools that actually simulate users. They actually have HP software, for example, sells one of these tools, but there are other lots of open source tools as well. The next step is detecting that there is a deviation from normalcy. So there is some performance issues in the application. And that's required because you'd only want to scale or change your deployment architecture if you detected that there is a problem. So there is a module that actually automatically detects performance problems and characterizes them. And that goes to into an action learning module, which takes the characterization of the performance problem, fingerprint, if you will, and maps it into an action that's required to keep to go back to the normal behavior, to the normal performance behavior. That goes into the Vayu knowledge base, classifies this fingerprint, and recommends an action. The action gets implemented, and this is key. It gets implemented, and monitoring is continuous, so you can actually observe whether the action helped or not resolve the performance problem. And if it did help, then the performance problem detection knows to close the problem and informs the action learning modules that the problem was solved. And then it gets stored into the knowledge base and as a positive feedback. If it's negative, then the action learning would recommend the next plausible action to take and would store that the previous action did not help. So one important aspect here is that the set of actions that we're assuming that the set of actions that can be taken is relatively small. It's about scaling. It's about could be some application-specific actions, but it's not the space of all configurations and all configuration changes possible for your application, which could be very large. That would make the learning part a bit infeasible because you would need to observe a lot of different behaviors to actually do the learning. So let me go a bit deeper into every part of the solution, especially the performance problem detection, and then the action learning part. So the performance problem detection and characterization is built of three layers. The first one is understanding the normal behavior of every monitor that we have, every metric. And for this, we developed an adaptive and additive baseline algorithm, and I'll give a bit more specification of it in the next slide. So detecting that one metric is behaving abnormally for even for some period of time probably doesn't mean that there is a real problem in your application. You want to detect an anomaly. And because we're looking at composite applications with multiple components, we want to take in all the information to say that there is a real, true problem in the application. And we combine both temporal metric deviation from patterns from the normalcy that we get from the baseline, and we use topological information about the architecture of the application to determine, to give a score whether there is an anomaly, and then detect that it exists. Lastly is the representation part, and here we represent the anomaly as a fingerprint, as a graph basically, which depends on the topology of the application. And this allows us to do the next step of finding what is two similar anomalies, understanding that two anomalies are similar to each other, which is really the critical step for doing the learning part. Because if we want to do any classification, we need to understand that what we have now, an anomaly we have now, is similar to one that we've seen in the past.
So what assumptions do you make with anomaly detection? So what assumptions about the underlying service?
What assumptions?
Yeah, homogeneity of behavior, that kind of stuff.
How much what?
A homogeneous behavior, scaling the number of users or requests.
Right. So there aren't actually almost any assumptions. Except that, so we're relying on the baseline to give us normal behavior. We're assuming that every metric, we're assuming that the metrics do not deviate too quickly from the normal behavior that it gets learned. Now, we're using an adaptive algorithm which can change over time, so if the user volume increases, it can actually, and let's say the CPU increases because of that, it can actually adapt to it. But we're assuming that it doesn't change very fast.
Right. At least you assume that every VM, given a similar load, because you have load balancing.
Yes,
yes. And then it will behave similarly.
Yes, exactly. So metric normal behavior learning, what do we do for that? We have a statistical baseline algorithm, and it has a few components that are important for it to be accurate. Because just doing baseline, I mean, there are tons of methods to do that. But from our experience, we had to do three things. The first one is to actually detect seasonal patterns. So a lot of applications have seasonal behavior. Most systems, at least commercial systems out there, require that you specify for every metric what is the season that is in it, if there is a season. So 24-hour season, or weekly pattern, or an hourly pattern. Most systems do not detect that automatically. We developed an algorithm to actually automatically detect the season. Once we have that, we can take it into account. So you can see that having a season really helps. Automatically detecting a trend is also important. And being adaptive is critical for cloud applications because things tend to change. So you need to be able to adapt quickly to changes that are valid, changes in the actual infrastructure that are completely valid. And the zero configuration is something that is really required of commercial systems if you're going to be deployed on large scale systems. Otherwise, users get lost in all these trying to configure these type of baselines or any type of analysis algorithms, mostly because they don't really know what to configure. So usually the defaults that you put there are the ones that always stay forever. So we wanted to have something that is very has minimal amount of parameters, and it actually requires no configuration from the end user. So first of all, why do we need to detect season? So this is a study that we did on about 46,000 different monitors, both business monitors and system monitors from large-scale systems from customers, and we saw that there are all sorts of seasons that exist in large-scale systems. 33% have no season, which is great because it means you can use all the data to compute the baseline statistics, and you don't have to look at different hours. The next one is 24-hour season, and then you have a weekly season, which is about 5%, A lot of them display a one-hour season. The point is that there are plenty of other seasons. Now, if you ignore the season that exists in your data, let's say you ignore it and do not take it into account, you're going to have a baseline which is very, very wide. Let's look at this kind of example. If I ignore the fact that there is some, and here it's a 24-hour season, if I ignore that fact, my baseline is going to be very wide because I'm going to have to take into account all the variability in these metrics. But if somebody specifies a wrong season, let's say I say it's a 13-hour season, but it's actually a 24-hour season, my baseline is going to be completely screwed up, and it's going to not follow my data well at all, and it's going to give me a lot of false alarms. So you want to be able to detect the season. The algorithm that we use, we've tried several options before we set on this, is a heuristic algorithm. It basically iterates over a set of possible seasons, and for all practical reasons, what we did is take all possible seasons in 1 hour increment from 0 to 168 hours, which is a week. And for each possible season, we compute the likelihood of that season being presenting, of having a seasonal patterns of that season in the data. And then, so this is an inverse likelihood, so we look at the minimum. This is an example of an error that's likelihood plotted for one of the metrics. And the season here is, you can see the minimum here, which is 24 hours. So the key is in this likelihood measure or inverse likelihood measure. And we choose the one that minimizes this negative likelihood. So some of the properties of this algorithm, so we can apply it to both real-valued metrics and also discrete valued metrics, so things that have only a few values that are ordinal but still only two, three, or four values. We have very high robustness to noise with this algorithm. We tested it on various noisy signals, and we saw that we can still get very good detection with even minus 23 dB of noise. We have high robustness to missing data, and the heuristic algorithm that we have, that's why we went with the heuristic algorithm, because a lot of times you would get measurements from systems that have chunks of data missing in it, not just single failures of data missing, and we had to be robust to that. And this is an example with 50% missing data. You can't see it in this plot, but 50% of the measurements are actually missing, and we're still able to detect the season correctly. So this is the seasonal part of the algorithm. I have 2 minutes, so I'm not going to go into the other parts. The anomaly detection method, basically what it does, it keeps tracks of all the metrics that exceeds their baseline. And it has a map, a topological map of the application, and it groups related metrics exceeding their baseline based on the topology, and then computes the probability that that the abnormal behavior of all these metrics is significant to determine whether an anomaly should be open or not. And the same goes to closing it. Once the significance goes down, the anomaly gets closed. So basically, the significance of anomaly is 1 minus the probability that what we observe in these abnormal metrics and topological behavior is normal. So it could be an application where, you know, 10 metrics are always out of their normal behavior. So the probability will be high that this is a normal behavior. And I won't go into this equation because I don't think we have time. If somebody wants more understanding of these algorithms, let's talk afterwards. So next phase is the action learning. So basically, how do we do action learning? So like I said, we do classification, and what we use is a k-nearest neighbor algorithm. And we take this characterization of every anomaly in the topology. Because it's represented as a topology, we needed to have a topology-based distance metric to understand whether one anomaly is the same as another. And what we do is we use a cost-sensitive classification because we want to take into account not just how close we are in this anomaly distance space, but also what's the cost of an action that is being recommended. So if we have two actions that are more or less equally likely, this is stop, but I have a few more slides, then we want to take into account what's the cost of actually taking the action, whether it's cheaper or not. So adding a web server is cheaper than adding a database server. Then we apply the most likely action being executed. VIO observes the effect of the action on the problem, and then stores the positive effect and stores the negative effect. And if it's a negative effect, means it didn't help, then you take the next most likely action by going back to the classification and seeing which is the next action to take. So let me skip the topology-based distance. It's also a very interesting algorithm, but I don't think we have time to go over it. The properties of it are that we get very, very high precision and recall in terms of distance. I've done some work on similarity between problems in the past. It was published, I think, in 2005 in SOSP. By using topology, we saw that we get huge improvement in terms of robustness of similarity between problems. So we have a distance function between problems, and this is how actually VIO learns. So on the top, you see my application. It has two web servers, a few app servers, and a database. And here is kind of a graphical representation of the fingerprint action space that we have. And it starts out with having few examples of problems and their positive action. And now let's say I have an anomaly. I observe an anomaly in the system. It's represented as high CPU on my web server, high network utilization on my web server, and high database CPU. And basically, we look for the anomaly with the smallest cost, so both distance and take into account cost. And we apply the action. So we add a web server, and then we observe that this action actually didn't resolve the problem. The anomaly didn't get closed in a small amount of time. Then we go and apply the next smallest cost and store the fact that this was a negative action. And of course, over time, this whole thing gets populated with a lot more information. I have a demo of how this works. I think we'll do it afterwards. So come by our demo, and I'll show you this video of how VIO actually works. So in summary, I'd like to play this short video.
Mr. Romney, what did you think of VIO?
I think it is the future. We must invest in it.
President Obama, your thoughts? For once, I agree. But Mr. Romney forgot something.
What is that?
It is Ira Cohen's birthday today.
Happy birthday, Ira.
So it's my birthday, and I have some chocolates if people want to come. Don't ask a difficult question.
Ira, I think this is great work. I think you guys are thinking in the right direction. I have way too many questions to ask you, so I'll take stuff offline.
Okay.
But I had a question. So when you talk about seasons, you led us to believe in the presentation that you identify one season. But there are definitely multi-level seasons, right?
Right.
So how do you take that into account?
Yeah, right now in the current implementation, basically it would find the, let's say you have, if you have a weekly and a 24-hour season, then it would find the weekly season because it's a multiple. And if you have, it would basically find the longest season or the, if they're not factors of each other, it will find a single season that is the multiplication of the two seasons. So 1 hour and 3 hour, well, 2 hours and 3 hours, it would find a 6 hour season. next phase is to actually try to break it down into multiple seasons, which is a bit harder.
Thanks.
But you're right.